Thank you. So, sorry, I'm going to be finishing up a lozenge. I'm getting over a cold that I've had for a bit of time. I'm not contagious, just a lingering cough. So hopefully we'll be all fine. But is the God of the Old Testament a God of smiting? And is this the same God as the God of the New Testament? Now, how do you actually answer a question like that? Because on the one hand, it's a completely unfair question intended to trap you. It's kind of like asking, have you stopped beating your wife yet? You know, there's no good answer to it, because if I say yes to this question, then in some ways I'm just accepting that there's a self-contradictory paradox of God's character. If I say no, then I seem to be acknowledging that there are two deities. But on the other hand, it really is a completely fair question. Because there is a tension we sense. There's a tension that we sense of the overall flavor of God that we seem to taste when we read the Old Testament versus the New Testament. Or at least that's what popular understanding would lead us to believe. But there's also a tension when we simply think about the tension we feel as humans between justice and mercy, between expressions of grace and judgment, between holiness and love. These are tensions that we would feel not only on a theological basis, but in our own society, of how do you balance giving people freedom, but also providing boundaries. So, in another way, it's a completely fair question to ask. And it's a question that has been asked for the ages. So, over here on the left, you see this mural. This is St. John, the guy who wrote the Gospel and Revelation and other things. And next to him is this person called Marcion, early Christian leader, who had this problem that we're talking about tonight. Marcion gathered his own version of the Bible. And in that version of the Bible, he decided to get rid of most of the Old Testament, because he felt that the Old Testament God was a God of wrath, and he couldn't make sense of how that fit with his understanding of Jesus. So in the Marcion version of the Bible, it was determined that there really are two gods. There's the God of the Old Testament, who was kind of a lower God, and then this kind of bigger, fuller God came in the New Testament, and he sent Jesus. And the Apostle John here is depicted as contesting with what would be deemed one of the first heretics of the church. But not only is this an ancient concern, it's also a contemporary question. I don't know if you've ever been on Quora, but it's a website that some folks from Facebook, who, after they made a bunch of money, decided we can just do anything we want to with our lives, they decided to found this discussion site where people just pose questions, and then you can start a string of queries. And this was one of the questions. My biggest problem with the Bible is reconciling the wrathful God of the Old Testament with the loving God of the New Testament. Does anyone else have a problem with these two totally opposing natures of God? And then there's this lengthy discussion as people go back and forth on this question. It's an ancient concern right from the beginning of the formation of the New Testament. It's a contemporary question that we have that you probably have struggled with yourself. And struggle is the right word, because it's a challenging question. It actually is a hostile question in the hands of some. So perhaps you know of Richard Dawkins, one of the main leaders of this new atheist movement. A scientist from Oxford wrote a book called The God Delusion. And as this ardent atheist, part of his argument revolves around this characterization of the Old Testament God. Toward the end of the book, he makes this conclusion: what makes my jaw drop is that people today should base their lives on such an appalling role model as Yahweh. And that is the Hebrew name for God used in the Old Testament. And even worse, that they should bossily try to force the same evil monster, whether fact or fiction, on the rest of us. So it's not just an intellectual question that we're asking to be easily resolved on a Friday night and we can get on with the rest of our lives. For some, this is a major stumbling block, not only to embracing the messages of the Bible, but even embracing a belief in God. How do we frame this problem? What are the issues that go in contributing to this problem? Well, when we think about the Old Testament God of smiting, there are actual specific examples that we can refer to. So a classic one would be in Deuteronomy, a little summary of what some have called the Holy War, that Israel was sent into the Promised Land and commanded to expunge the Canaanites. And as they were making their journey to the Promised Land, one of the first groups of people they met were the Amorites, led by King Sihon. And so when Sihon and all his army came out to meet us in battle at Jahaz, the Lord our God delivered him over to us, and we struck him down, together with his sons and his whole army. At that time, we took all his towns and completely destroyed them, men, women, and children. We left no survivors. Now, I understand that with a question as complex as the one that we're posing, that I can't possibly address every concern about the characterization of God in the Old Testament versus the New Testament. Nor can I address every suspected contradiction between the ways that the New Testament and the Old Testament create their ethical system. In fact, I actually would argue that it would be disappointing if I could answer them quickly in one evening. It'd be disappointing because it would point to a simplistic Bible that just wouldn't be true to or even sufficient for the complexities of life. I mean, if the Bible were that simple as to be resolved in one evening, then it really is not a work for our lives. Nor would it be a very compelling vision of the complex, mysterious God that is the transcendent creator of all things. I mean, seriously, could we explain that God that simply? You know, one of the best pieces of marriage advice that was given to me someone said, you know, there are two ways to please a spouse, and no one knows either of them. And the point of that, yeah, you think about that for a little bit, right? Marty, you know exactly what I'm talking about. The point of that is, you should always be curious about people, because there's always something to surprise you about them. There's always something left to be learned. And the saddest thing in a marriage is the loss of curiosity. Just the basic assumption, and this is true of all, this is true of friendship. It's true of any community. When you lose curiosity, when you think you just completely understand the other person, there's no room for growth. So, I am not going to resolve all these questions, and they are not resolvable. But I do want to frame some ways of approaching this issue. And one is to acknowledge the truth that statements like this from the Old Testament do offend us. They appear morally offensive. They appear problematic as a picture of God. And maybe this is why people so quickly move from the Old Testament and just, like, let's just get to Jesus, because it's just so much nicer to deal with Jesus, right? I mean, look at him. He looks really nice. Yeah, exactly, right? You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. This is why people love Jesus. He says stuff like this. Love, love. We can embrace a God of love. And this statement of Jesus seems to directly contradict what God in the Old Testament had actually commanded his people to do, to destroy the enemies. Well, not only are the problems of specific Old Testament statements that appear to us morally offensive or problematic in their depiction of God, and then you layer on top of that what appears to be a New Testament contradiction, the moral vision of Jesus, who claims to be God incarnate, conflicts with what appears to be the depiction of the Old Testament. So you layered that problem, taking on its own morally offensive statements, layered with a contradictory vision of God. What do we do with this? And to complicate matters even more, we live in a certain age that prizes a way of thinking about love. Love without conflict. Love that seems to embrace. All we need is love, right? We make songs out of stuff like that. Yeah, there was a few years back a documentary by a filmmaker who wanted to ask just the basic question. So he went all over the world, several different countries, interviewed all sorts of people, some celebrities, other commoners, people from different religious backgrounds or no religious background, and asked the simple question, what is God? This is a part of the trailer to that movie, that documentary I'm going to play. You can probably check out the generational divide here. If you recognize the first theologian, Wolverine, you know, that puts you in a certain age group. And if you recognize Ringo Starr from the Beatles, that puts you in a different age group. But the thing that's common about both Hugh Jackman and Ringo Starr and all the people that were interviewed in this is a common affirmation that whatever God we have or wish to worship, it's the God of love. That's the God we want. So, I propose that this evening we focus a bit on the Old Testament directly and try to make sense of the Old Testament ethical world. How do we frame and reframe the problem? If the problem is trying to make sense of the Old Testament statements that are morally offensive or problematic in their envisioning of God, and the New Testament, which seems to be contradictory, is there a reframing, especially in the context in which we live, a culture that values pluralism in such a fashion that we just all want to get along? Is there a way of actually reframing the problem? And I would look to Jesus, actually, to help us reframe the problem. And I'm going to look and give you a case study. I'm going to maybe approach this. If you went to law school, you'll be in familiar turf here. We're going to look at some case studies. And this is Jesus' teaching in Matthew chapter 19 on marriage and divorce. So some Pharisees came to him to test him. They asked, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? Okay. Now this is a present, at that time, a contemporary application of a teaching in Deuteronomy chapter 24. Right? Although in Deuteronomy chapter 24, not every and any reason was legitimate, but it came to be that case for the time of the Pharisees. Jesus replied, haven't you read that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female and said, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate. Why then, they asked, did Moses command that a man give his wife a certificate of divorce and send her away? Again, reference to Deuteronomy chapter 24, first several verses. And Jesus replied, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard. But it was not this way from the beginning. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another woman, commits adultery. Now, this is not going to be a full-blown exposition of this passage and the ethics of marriage and divorce. I do want to draw some principles of the way Jesus actually interpreted the Old Testament, how he understood the ethical teachings of the Old Testament, as a key for how we could approach and try to tackle some of the issues of the Old Testament. Well, one of the things that was very apparent is that everyone understood you had to understand the historical context. Why then, they asked, did Moses command a man to give his wife a certificate of divorce and send her away? What was the historical context for that original commandment? Now, I'm not going to give you the answer to that, other than I just want to pose that that was an important issue to figure out. The original historical context. And the second thing is, we need to differentiate between law and ethics. So, Jesus replied, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard. In other words, as far as legal theory, both of the Bible, but actually contemporary legal theory upon which our society is based, is that you put into law the lowest common denominator of what is enforceable, not your highest moral value. It is why we can have a political cycle in which racist or sexist comments are made and no one goes to jail. Now, that doesn't mean we're a society that actually values racist and sexist statements or values lying about, you know, just to be political, I'm not, on both sides, or lying to your government. You know, it's not like we say that these are our highest moral ideas. Just because we don't make racist, sexist, inflammatory comments, or even lying to one another, a law, it does not mean that it is a moral value. So how do laws function? Laws function in order to try to create a society that is safe for bad people. Right? Safe for people who make mistakes, who will inflict harm. So how can you contain that and still retain some measure of freedom? That's why we don't have laws for every single wrong that could be done. In the Old Testament, that wasn't the case. In American society, that's not the case. In any society. So one of the things that we have to realize is that we should apply the same kind of understanding to the Old Testament law that we would for our own legal system. And that is to differentiate between what is codified in laws and what a society may aspire to in their ethics. Right? So in American society, we aspire to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We aspire to all men are created equal, even though in our Constitution, there was a group of people who were only three-fifths human. So, in the Old Testament, Jesus actually acknowledges that there was an ethic that was very high and not achievable, so you had to create laws on a lower level to enforce and minimize the harm that would be done to women who had no recourse to economic security if they didn't have certain laws created around divorce. Right? So, understand the original historical context, and also understand that when you encounter laws or even descriptions of narratives, that there is probably a difference between the ethical ideal that the Bible would hold forth and the legal manifestation of it, or even the narrative manifestation of it. Right? And again, you know, during the Q&A, we can come back to these things, but I just want to lay out some principles. And then the second thing is, Jesus reminds us to remember that there's a larger context. Deuteronomy chapter 24 comes after four books prior and 23 more chapters after that, right? So there's a long narrative and set of laws that come before Deuteronomy chapter 24, and a whole set of prophetic material that will come over the centuries that help you interpret what Deuteronomy chapter 24 actually is saying. There's a whole covenant context for understanding this one command. So Jesus replied, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard, but it was not this way from the beginning. And here Jesus is starting to give us a clue that there's a larger context in which to interpret the laws of the Old Testament. In fact, what he is arguing is that there is a redemptive trajectory. Jesus replied, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard, but it was not this way from the beginning. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another woman, commits adultery. So clearly, in the beginning, he's referring to Genesis chapter 1. The gift that God had created humanity in his image, male and female. He's created them in the image of God. And then in chapter 2, God created Adam and Eve to together rule over the Garden of Eden as kind of this first royal priestly family who would mediate the presence of God to the world and represent the concerns of the world to God. They were given that job together. Adam couldn't do it by himself. Eve couldn't do it by herself. It required joint endeavor. That was the high point of morality. That is the ideal. And after the fall, laws were instituted to safeguard a world of sinful people from inflicting harm against each other. Not because God was content. No, there was an actual loss of ideal that we need to get back to, or maybe even supersede. All right, so given these principles that Jesus is helping us see, the challenges of reading the Old Testament have certain keys of interpretation that we could apply. So let's go ahead and do that with a specific problem. Now, again, there are tons of problems. We could do polygamy, we could do holy war, you name it, we could do a bunch. I'm picking only one, and we'll have some Q&A to talk about some others. I'm picking one because I want to demonstrate a way of thinking about the problem. Okay? And we're going to pick slavery. The issue of race is big now, so slavery seems like an appropriate topic. Slavery in the Old Testament, it was there. And that's one of the things that Richard Dawkins, Christian Hitchens, others of the new atheist movement, maybe even peers that you have engaged in discussion, or you yourself have found problematic. Why doesn't the Bible, and especially Old Testament, why doesn't it say something direct against slavery? That would have spared us all the trauma of Christians before the Civil War trying to justify slavery. Well, one, let's follow Jesus' pattern and apply his principles to the Old Testament. Let's understand the historical context. And understand that what we mean by slavery has a very different historical context from what we understand in the ancient world as slavery, and particularly in the world of Israel. Now, this became very apparent to me, that you can use the same word, slave, and mean two very different things. And we can access the meaning of this in very common, mundane ways, right? So, if I tell you I like to tweet, you know exactly what I mean. You know that I like to get onto social media, and I like to spout out things in about 140 characters, right? I actually don't, but you would get what I mean. I like to tweet. No problem. 10 years ago, if I told you I like to tweet, you would look at me like, what in the world are you talking about? You would like, is this guy going to start going like, buck, 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 buck at me or something? You know, tweet had a completely different meaning before Twitter came into existence. Yes, it was only 10 years ago. There was no Twitter. The same word tweet vastly different meanings. We have to understand the historical context to get at its meaning. Now, we come from a very specific historical context for understanding the meaning of slavery. Slavery was involuntary in our context. It was violent. I mean, the number of people that were killed and tortured is appalling. It was based on a racial theory of superiority of the Anglo-Caucasian race. And it was systemic. That it was not just isolated, but an entire systemic approach to the relationship between races and to the economics of the South and social structure. So it was not simple just to eliminate it on an individual basis. It was a systemic issue. Now, I want to contend that slavery talked about in the Bible has nothing to do with this kind of slavery. We're talking about a completely different system. That in the ancient world, and in Israel especially, the terminology slavery applies to debt servitude, not racial slavery. And so you read in Deuteronomy, if any of your people, Hebrew men or women, sell themselves to you and serve you 6 years, in the seventh year, you must let them go free. See, there weren't banks in the ancient world. You couldn't take out a Pell Grant in order to pay for your college education. In order to be able to do your crops or to barter, if you got in a bad way, there was only one commodity that most people could exchange for paying off a loan. It was their own labor. So in the ancient world, this was not really a system of racial oppression. It was primarily, especially in Israel, it was a system of paying off debt with the only commodity that you had accessible, your own labor. Okay. So that's why when slavery is described, it's described in these kinds of terms, of paying off debts. In 7 years, seemed like a reasonable amount of time for people to be able to pay off their debts. Now, was slavery that benign? No. Of course, given power, everyone could abuse that economic system. Not only on an individual household level of someone paying off a debt made to you, but also on a social level of nations conquering other nations, right? The Assyrians, Babylonians, they brought this to an art form, subjugation of other peoples. So what Israel, in its formulation even of debt servitude, was careful to do, what God in the Old Testament seeks to do, is to provide countercultural protection. Something that would have been astonishing to the Assyrians and the Babylonians about the way that debt servitude and slavery was given parameters, boundaries, to ensure the dignity of the person who went into debt. So, you have here, if a slave has taken refuge with you, do not hand them over to their master. Let them live among you wherever they like and in whatever town they choose. Do not oppress them. What's the logic behind this statement? The logic behind this statement is, in Old Testament, you always side with the weak. There was a basic assumption that if a slave was running away, it was probably because he or she was being abused by someone in power. And given that power imbalance in the Old Testament law, you always sided with the vulnerable. This was in stark contrast with everything that existed around Israel. So this is a tablet of the Code of Hammurabi. Maybe you heard of Hammurabi, great Babylonian king, around 1750 BC, created this massive code, a set of legal systems, 282 laws that formed the basis of Babylonian law. Some of the laws actually have it formed in Exodus and Deuteronomy as well. It became kind of a standard
in the ancient world for how you did law. So, one of the 282 was a law that was very similar, the similar situation to the one we find in the Bible. But note the difference. If anyone received into his house a runaway male or female slave of the court, or a freedman, and does not bring that person out at the public proclamation, "Hey, my slave ran away, did he run into your town? Let me know." The master of that house who accommodated this runaway slave will be put to death. Babylonian system, who do you side with? You side with the person in power. The default position is we trust the person in economic power. One of the basic principles in the Old Testament, and this is really a principle of parenting, it's a principle even in our own constitution, is that you develop laws that begin with where people are at to train them in order to transform them. I teach my kids basic rules of politeness around the dinner table. I train them up. You start with something basic. I do this every January when I make my New Year's resolution of getting back into shape, right? I remember how many push-ups I could do when I was 21 years old. If I started with that ambition of, gosh, I'm just going to whip out 60 push-ups in a row, I just couldn't do it. A six would be a major accomplishment for me. So I can't go back to my glory day, but I do want to go toward it through a system of beginning where I am at. We have the inability to live out our glory day, which was Genesis chapter 1 and 2. We are not able, even today, to live out our image of God. Male and female, He created them. Do we really have gender equality in our highly developed society? No. We have a complete inability to live up to even what was the glory day of Genesis chapters 1 and 2. So the law, like every law, is extremely practical. Not because it believes that this is the pinnacle of human existence, but it is the springboard from which you can start training. Right? So, in the Old Testament, there was conception. If we started with the abolition of slavery, even in its debt servitude form, there would be a total collapse of the economy. There would be no ability for a society to function. So we will begin with an acknowledgement of a system that is imperfect, but it is dominant. But we will build into that system safeguards and a logic that actually undermines the system itself and guarantees its elimination. This is training in order to transform. Much of the law of the Old Testament is developed with that in mind. And then, of course, not only do you have the historical context, a counter-cultural statement against the Assyrian and Babylonian and Hittite laws, and also an internal training to become the kind of people of God that would be transformed and approximate the glory days of Genesis chapter 1 and 2, as well as a future redemption, a trajectory that God would actually seek to take them. And that was accomplished by situating these individual laws in the broad context of the entire teaching of the Old Testament. So you'll see that laws about slavery were radically limited by Genesis chapter 1. So this is in Job. And Job is speaking about not only himself, but about slaves. Okay? So he's speaking about slaves. Did not he who made me in the womb also make them slaves? Did not the same one form us both within our mothers? So baked into the logic of the Old Testament theology is the radical equality of humans. Slave, or in Job's case, one of the most powerful, rich men, all from the same womb. Again, this stands in stark contrast to the ancient Near East. This is a stele of King Esarhaddon, the Neo-Assyrian king, around 660 BC. And this is one of the priests writing about the king. Free man is as the shadow of the god. The slave is as the shadow of the free man. But the king, he is like unto the very image of God. See, in the ancient world, only kings bore the image of God. Only the Pharaoh was the manifestation of Ra. Or in this case, only King Esarhaddon could represent the high god Bel. Everyone else was just not even shadows of really the king itself. I mean, slave, you're way farther down the totem pole. So again, even within the Old Testament, built into the system is a logic that will radically undermine the way that humans relate to each other. And this differentiation of law from ethics. Again, you see this with the Old Testament. Paul Copen describes, again, the difference between a moral pinnacle versus a moral springboard. That the law is not the moral pinnacle, but it is a moral springboard. So when you release them, the slaves, do not send them away empty-handed. Supply them liberally from your flock, your threshing floor, and your wine press. Give to them as the Lord your God has blessed you. This is absolutely astounding in the ancient Near East. First of all, that you would have to free your slaves every seventh year would be astounding. The loss of income to you. I mean, that you are actually losing income by that point, right? So it's a material loss. On top of that, you're supposed to send this person out so that they can launch their own business and never have to go back into debt servitude. This is the ultimate, yes, I am my brother's keeper. And so the law, while acknowledging the existence of debt servitude, says this is not the moral pinnacle we want to stop at. It's just a springboard we want to launch onto, which enables a redemptive trajectory in the Old Testament. That slavery as an institution itself became a grand metaphor for the way that God would seek to relate to the world. So if any of you people, your people, Hebrew men or women, sell themselves to you and serve you for 6 years, in the seventh year you must let them go. Go free. And when you release them, do not send them away empty-handed. Supply them liberally from your flock, your threshing floor, and your winepress. Give to them as the Lord your God has blessed you. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. And that is why I give you this command today. So all throughout the Old Testament, you see that last phrase, set of verses reiterated. The constant logic for these laws was the fact that you yourselves were once slaves. And you have been liberated. So all the law actually has a purpose, not only for moral training, but spiritual fine-tuning to help you catch the pulse of God's redemptive purposes in this world. To take people who are oppressed and to liberate them. The slaves of the Israelites in Egypt, liberated miraculously, graciously, apart from anything that they deserved. And God made that point at the beginning of Deuteronomy. I did not save you because you were a big nation. No, you're the smallest. I didn't save you because you were a righteous nation. No, you're stiff-necked and stubborn. You did really nothing to deserve my saving you. The only thing that drove me to save you was the fact that you were slaves and you were in need. And that produced a response of compassion on my part. The law itself was not just moral training, but it was spiritual fine-tuning. These are new pair of glasses. I just picked them up this afternoon. I had lost my other pair, maybe a month, 2 months ago, and I was too cheap to get a new pair right away. hoping that I can find them. Finally, I just gave up. I decided I'm never going to find my glasses, so I bought a new pair. After about a week or two of not having glasses, I just kind of got used to not having glasses, and I just saw the world a certain way. Like right now, you're just blotches of fuzz on top of bigger blotches of bodies, right? I mean, I don't really see you. So when I picked up my glasses this afternoon and I put them on and I started driving, I realized, oh my goodness, I was a hazard for the last month on the roads of Boston. I should not have been on these roads. I can see now. The law should be like that. For a world that after the fall was unable to see its way to the equal image of God, to the high calling of being royal priests tending to the created order, in a world that was no longer able to see that, the law was like putting on glasses to begin to be able to see the purposes of God. And so the Old Testament law is in fact kind of this trajectory. We have creation and the fall, and the Old Testament is a harsh diagnosis. The Old Testament is a harsh diagnosis for just how bad sin is. But it is also, within that harsh diagnosis, it is a cure. Or at least it points us to the cure. The motif of slavery and deliverance from slavery leads to all sorts of redemptive images, whether it's of the benevolent king, or the righteous priest, or the just prophet, whether it was the institution of the sacrificial system, or the presence of God at the temple, whether it was the wisdom literature that sought to navigate and create a society that was just. Whatever it was, these were Old Testament redemptive pictures that made us ready for the New Testament manifestation of Christ, the ultimate cure of the diagnosis that the Old Testament gives us. With an anticipation of our future consummation in the new heavens and the new earth. Now, C.S. Lewis, in this sermon called The Weight of Glory, describes music and books and the beauties that we find in music and in books and the scent of a flower. And he said, we used to think that beauty was found in them. But that is actually not true. The beauty wasn't in the books or in the music. Because if we trusted in them, we would be disappointed. It was actually in what they were beckoning us toward. Toward a country we have not yet heard of. The scent of a flower we have not yet discovered. But we know to be there. Again, this is the Old Testament. It's not the moral pinnacle. It's the springboard for discovery of the ultimate society that God would seek to create in the new people of the new heavens and the new earth. So I'm just going to stop right here. Again, I have no delusions of grandeur. I know there are all sorts of specific questions about the Old Testament that you could be asking, and conceptual questions about the framework of what I'm talking about that you could be exploring, pushing, contradicting, asking questions about. But I did want to give you some tools in your toolbox that you yourself could start applying as you think about the conundrums of Old Testament ethics. So I'm going to pause right here, and I think this is where we go into Q&A.
Yeah. So if anybody's had an interview before, we always have a time of discussion and Q&A. Really just as long as Walter's still standing. So we'll let him get to drive back into Boston tonight, so we'll let him kind of cut it off when he feels ready. But feel free to ask questions. If you need to go, feel free to go. So nobody's required to stay some dinner.
Okay, yes.
How do you answer the objection when the Israelites were commanded to attack, probably going to use the wrong ite here, but like the Amalekites or someone else, and then to take them as slaves?
Yeah.
Because I've heard that objection many times, and I was just wondering how you would answer that.
Yeah. So
There are several things to that. First of all, you know, when the cleansing of the promised land. I mean, it definitely is one of the issues that has been raised as seriously morally problematic, perhaps even the basis for justifying, you know, ethnic cleansing during the Bosnian War, for instance, or in Rwanda and the genocide of, you know, in Rwanda between the Hutu and the Tutsi. And so, yeah, there are points of analogy and criticism that people level. And again, on a superficial level, that could be conceivable to see how that might work out and be a point of comparison. But here, let me give you some, again, principles for which I would say there are tremendous differences. One, this was not about ethnic cleansing. It was very clear that it was about a religious issue. Okay, so that might not be any better in people's estimations. But first, let's at least be clear about what the issue is. Just like slavery, it wasn't a racial issue, it wasn't an ethnic issue. It was a religious issue. And that does raise up the question, does God have the right to be worshipped in the way he requires, with purity? Right? So it is a problematic question that poses at the heart of it, what is God's right to require of humans as worship? Right? So if the Canaanites were presenting false pictures of God that were an offense to God, does God have a right to judge that? So that's the first question. So let's make it clear. It wasn't ethnic. It was, in fact, about the appropriate worship of God. The second thing is that it wasn't ultimately about a superpower. One of the things we find so offensive, thank you, one of the things that we find so offensive in the use of power is when a world power, a very strong force, beats up on a very weak force, right? That's just morally, we call that bully. We call that a bully, whether it's on a playground or whether it's a superpower wielding its influence on a smaller country. The thing we need to realize is that the Canaanites were the highly developed society. They were the ones with chariots. The Israelites were fighting with sticks and stones. So the picture that we tend to have is of the Israelites being these big bad army rolling into the Canaanites. The Canaanites are these helpless people just getting wiped out by this superpower, the Israelites. And that was not the case at all. The Canaanites had all the power. So even in this principle, there is God siding with the weak, with the Israelites. So this is the second principle that I would like to put out. The third principle is God's immense patience. We, again, tend to think that, okay, God delivered the Israelites from Egypt. They're walking in the desert. Now God has to come up with a plan. Oh, darn. I didn't figure out where I'm going to put these people. Now they're out of Egypt. Okay. Okay, how about over there? So we'll kick these people out. Well, according to Genesis, when God made his first promise to Abraham, the forebear of the people of God, God said, I will give you this land. And I will give this land, the promised land, to you and your heir, your people, your legacy, but not yet. Because the sins of the Amorites have not reached their full. In Genesis chapter 15. I will not give you this land until 400 years later. So the judgment that God made against the Amorites, the Amalekites, the, you know, Hittites, Jebusites, all these folks, that was 400 years in the making. It wasn't just 4 months of traveling and God deciding, I'm going to wipe these people. It was 400 years of God patiently working with this people. And I would argue that God actually was revealing himself to them. Because in Genesis, you see, in Genesis chapter 14, you see Abraham going into the land and getting to the city of Salem. And he meets this priest called Melchizedek, who was a true priest of God, working in that land among the Amorites, representing the true God. This is actually totally apart from the promises that God had made to Abraham.
So it's like we stepped into another story and realized, oh my goodness, there's this whole story going on. I have no clue what's happening here. So for 400 years, we get this little like one intersection with Melchizedek. But that intersection reveals to us, from the time of Abraham, for 400 years, God had someone like Melchizedek preaching, you must repent from your child sacrifices. You must repent from your abuse of power. Because in the Canaanite system, all the land, see, in the Israelite system, every family owned its own land. In the Canaanite system, the entire land belonged to the king. And everyone depended on the king and the king's mercy to actually be able to work the land. Right? It's a very abusive system. For 400 years, God was preaching against it, apparently. And God said, finally, I've had enough. I'm going to bring judgment against this people. So that's the third principle of God's surprising work. That just gives us a snapshot. Doesn't describe it, but gives us a snapshot that God was actually at work. The fourth principle that I would give you is that in Deuteronomy chapter 20, it describes the rules of warfare. And for, aside from Jericho and Ai, there are instances in which God just commanded, for whatever reason, maybe the immense evil of these cities, just go in and destroy them. But for all the other cities, there were very distinct rules. You had to offer peace first. And if they surrendered, you must accept that. And you must incorporate that people. And the foreigner among you will be protected. That's just, again, astounding. That God's protection would even be for the Canaanites, who their whole history has been one of abuse. But God actually cared for any Canaanite who wishes to no longer serve a despot, but wishes to serve a God who would seek to give a parcel of land for you. Then yes, come. Surrender into actually your freedom. So, I mean, there are more things that I could say, but I think those are some principles that I would lay out in terms of, reframing what actually was going on. And okay, the last thing I just threw in. So on the one hand, there is, I think, a little bit of biblical hyperbole when it says that God destroyed all this city. But then in the very next chapter in Joshua, so at the beginning of Joshua, you see Joshua going around destroying these cities and think everyone's gone. But at the end of Joshua, we realize there's still a bunch of Canaanites there. So it seems that this is simply the way that the biblical writers write. They write not with an eye toward like this precise percentage detail. They write with the broad brushstrokes of God's stark command. But actually the stark command has baked into it the assumption that you're truly not going to destroy everyone. Because Joshua at the end was not criticized for not having completely actually destroyed the city. And those people were brought and incorporated into, people like the Jebusites and others were incorporated into the people. So again, we need to understand the rules for how the Bible was written. All right, so I kind of went long about that, but just I'll come back to you, but maybe to get a different question.
I appreciate your point about training in order to transform.
Yes.
That there's this larger telos of future consummation. But I'm curious about the Levitical laws that, if broken, resulted in stoning.
Yes.
The penalty, whether it's lying to your parents or I'm reading one about if a girl was raped and didn't cry out, she would get stoned. Just all of these broken commandments resulted in that death.
Yes.
And if that was, just curious about that, and then Jesus commanding that nobody throw the first stone if they themselves hadn't sinned, and in regards to the woman who was caught in adultery, and just that contrast, and was the stoning typically carried out? I mean, and just your thoughts on why eradication of that person who committed that sin.
Yeah. Great question, and you both of you are tapping into the big hard questions, right?
So that's fantastic. So I would say let's have several principles of ways of navigating this situation, springboard versus the pinnacle. And that is, it is even today, we actually have this in our own legal system, that there are death penalties in many of our states that are never enforced. But they are there to indicate the gravity. They are there to indicate the maximum, not the minimum requirement, but the maximum possibility. And most instances will never be given. So you even see that. You see in any case, you're like, well, the judge could give anywhere between 2 months and 10 years for this. Right? So there's a range. With the expectation that very rarely will a judge ever give the maximum penalty for a crime. But the maximum penalty is articulated in order to teach you a principle of proportionality, of the grave nature of this crime. So, yes, the death penalty was stipulated for a variety of things. You know, breaking the Sabbath could have a death penalty. Certain sexual infractions could have a death penalty. Actually, it's far less than sometimes is caricaturized for the Bible. But I will still acknowledge that it was there. I would say there is a legal a principle at work there that's still at work in all of our, all, even modern societies, and that is at times you will codify the maximum penalty in order to teach an ethical principle of the importance, the relative importance of this law, which you yourself will have very rare intentions of ever actually enforcing. Okay? Which is why we almost never see in the Old Testament. There's one instance in which the breaking of the Sabbath is enforced. You actually don't see that. So I'll give you another situation. Adultery. Adultery is punishable in certain instances, but with a death penalty. And again, unlike the other countries at the time in which only the women would get killed, it's both the man and the woman caught in the act of adultery. Very specific laws to protect that, make sure it's, you know, you can't have it by hearsay, two witnesses have to be there. Two witnesses in an act of adultery, that's going to be really hard to find. So all of a sudden you begin to see the practical implications by requiring two witnesses for an act of adultery. How many times have we committed, you know, you get my point, right? There's certain sins if you're committing, very unlikely that you'll have two witnesses. So what's the actual legal system doing? It's creating a moral principle that will rarely be enforced and have boundaries on it to actually guarantee it will not be enforced very often. All right? And on top of that, there are other principles at play that indicate what are the true value systems of the Old Testament law. Old Testament law always values people over property. Right? Always values. That's why the difference between the Code of Hammurabi, a slave disappears, that's loss of income. You hide that slave, you're going to get killed, right? No, we'd rather protect the slave from abuse than support the economic system. I'll give you a very curious instance of this. Prostitution is rampant all through the Old Testament. Now, think about this. How could this be? Even Solomon, the wisest king, you know, touted to be the wisest king, the first legal case given to him, if you recall the story, is of two prostitutes coming, and they each have a baby, one of them dies, and the two prostitutes claim that the remaining baby is theirs. Wisest man on earth. He finds a solution, gets the baby to the right mom. Never once does he say something about prostitution. Wait a second. You two are prostitutes. And by definition, you are in the practice of breaking the commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery. Your whole business is predicated on the fact that you are getting people to commit adultery. And yet, Solomon had no compulsion to prosecute the prostitute. And in fact, nowhere does God actually make prostitution illegal. How in the world does this make sense? You create the death penalty for adultery, but the one social institution that practices adultery the most is not even made illegal. And in fact, some of the greatest heroes of the Old Testament were prostitutes.
and they get into the genealogy of the kings. Rahab, right in Jesus' genealogy. This is the application I'm suggesting to you. Because in the ancient world, this is not justifying it. This is merely God dealing with the reality of the ancient world. In the ancient world, if a woman lost her husband, had no property, there were very few sources of income. It would have done women a greater harm to make prostitution illegal in that particular social situation, because it would give them no recourse for income. So I think that's why God never made the one institution that, by definition, because everyone got married young back then, by definition would be breaking the law of adultery and requiring the death penalty, wasn't made illegal. Because it was greater value in God's estimation to protect the disenfranchised woman. And so God was totally fine with adultery. I mean, with prostitution. Totally fine with protecting it. But building into it the ultimate demise of that institution by giving women rights. So, women at the end of the book of Numbers, these daughters of Zelophehad, come up and say, there's no son, our father didn't have any son, who's going to get the land? You know, women, we know women never get land, so what's going to happen to our family because there are no sons in our family? And God says at the end of the book of Numbers to Moses, Moses takes the case to God, like, okay, this is a good one. There's nothing in the Code of Hammurabi or anywhere else that covers this one. God says, from now on, the daughters of Zelophehad have this land. And it's theirs in perpetuity. So God actually bakes into the system women's rights. With the ultimate understanding that if Israel followed God's way, they actually would take care of the adultery problem, the prostitution problem, the women's rights problem as time went on. And it led to what Jesus was able to say. In an act of protecting that sinful woman who had no other recourse, perhaps because of her social standing, without at the same time excusing her sin. So I think this is the absolute brilliance, I would argue, of the Old Testament law. Rather than being an expression of a wrathful, narrow-minded God, it is so amazingly textured in its ability to train up a society in justice. I don't know if that helps, but yeah. So my answers are probably going way longer than you want, but yeah.
So besides resorting to a dad wanting his kids to help him work on the car kind of analogy, why would you suppose God involves us in his judgment dealing with people? Why doesn't he just Sodom and Gomorrah everybody and just kill them himself?
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of those inscrutable, like, God is more complex than we are kind of thing. But, I think actually, your analogy is the perfect analogy in so many ways. Because one of the reasons why is when you father working with the son, then you are taking and teaching a point that we are of the same category, right? We're both humans capable of work, right? So in the ancient world, again, only the king bore the image of God. So going back, I wish I had a picture of this. So you have to use your imagination. Where is the Code of Hammurabi? Yeah. So the original Code of Hammurabi, this is actually a copy of the original Code of Hammurabi. So the original Code of Hammurabi was this big black stone with the etching of all the laws. And on top of that stone, maybe you'll see it if you ever look up pictures of it, of Hammurabi talking with his God. Right? And then underneath is this listing of laws, of which this is a copy. In the ancient world, only the king bore the image of God. No one else was involved in this work. In the Bible, in Deuteronomy chapter 6, it commands you fathers, you parents, teach your children this law. Bind it upon their minds or hearts, on their foreheads and their wrists. So actually, the law, which in every other country was only the domain of the king to teach, was the responsibility of every person to teach. So you are actually, why does God involve us in this? Because he wants to teach us that we are actually all royalty. It's not just teaching us that, you know, we're kids being trained up. It's actually teaching us that we are kings and priests. We are God's ambassadors. It's an act of dignity. And then it's just, you know, I mean, engaging us, I mean, just heuristically. If you had to come up here and give this message tonight, you would learn this material much better than sitting as passive listeners. Right? There's always something about you apply it, and you yourself, you have to teach it, and you learn it so much better. So I think it's a heuristic thing. So one, it's an identity thing to teach us we're all in the image of God and we're all kings. And second thing, I think it's a heuristic thing that you're always, by embracing it, incarnating it, you know, you are manifesting. And that incarnation thing is also, it in and of itself, is kind of a foreshadow of the way that God would lead. I mean, God could have just forgiven us if he so chose, but he chose to take on the form of a servant, embody, incarnate. So I think maybe in some ways this is a foreshadowing of the fact that the law will be embodied in a person one day perfectly. And that's why we're practicing at it. It is preparing us to look for, I'm never able to live out this law perfectly. Who is going to ever do this? Well, it's Jesus. Jesus, the true embodiment. That's why he says, I did not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. I think to embody it, to bring it to its full trajectory.
Yeah. Just a quick question. Well, it's not a quick question. something you said a minute ago, one of the principles to hold on to as you read the account of the conquest of Canaan, is, or one of the questions you need to ask is, does God have the right to demand a certain kind of worship?
Yes.
Or does he not?
Yes.
And the same question could be asked, say, at Sinai, when Moses comes down the hill and sees the camp worshiping the golden calf and sort of calls the faithful to him, and they go through and lay waste to the camp. In our modern kind of, you know, relativistic world, that just is so offensive because it's, I guess we have a very hard time taking, even believing Christians have a hard time taking idolatry that seriously.
Yes.
Let alone if someone is not a Christian and basically thinks life should be about just tolerating everybody.
Yeah.
It's just, my question is, how do we, do you have any advice for how to communicate the gravity of worshiping something that's not God?
Yeah.
To people in a world who basically think it's a matter of personal preference like anything else, and just how dare you claim that your God has this right? That's the question. Right?
Yeah.
How dare you claim to have a right to tell me that I can't worship whoever I feel like worshiping?
Yeah.
To me, that's one of the texts that is just, man, I have a very hard time. If I was sitting down in church and I brought a friend who wasn't a Christian and that was the text for the morning.
Yeah. that's like the worst feeling.
Yeah. Anyway, I'll just throw that out there and let you.
No, man, that's a great question. And let me take a completely counterintuitive tack with that. And that is, you have no ability to measure love without measuring its sacrifice. Right. So, you know, someone could tell me, I just love you so much. And then for Christmas, they send me a $5 gift certificate from Amazon. Like, okay, I know what you now mean by love. Right? You love me, $5 Amazon worth. Right? Or I could have someone run into a burning fire and extract me at the cost of her own life. And now I have a much better picture of love. Right? So, I would argue that one way that we could look at this, and again, this is counterintuitive and completely from the back door, but I think it actually gets us to the same place, but in a way that's disarming. And that is the cross of Christ. What kind of problem could require an act of love that great? Like, what kind of dangerous situation was the world in that required a sacrifice that immense? A love that great to conquer an evil that real. I would begin with that. You know, because then, again, it's a very different point of view. And then I would come back and say, you know what? It's not that so much that God is this maniacal narcissist. It's because he loves you that much. And so, picking up on the love theme as well, again, this is a second counterintuitive argument that is on the basis of love. I love my wife immensely. So one of the ways I show my wife my love is my self-sacrifice for her, right? So I defer to her in this way or that, in this way or that. But another way that I would show my love to her is the immense jealousy I would feel if someone started hitting on her. Or if she were starting to contemplate having an affair with someone. Now, if I really didn't love her, then I wouldn't care. But it is precisely because I love her that I care and am jealous. Jealousy, yes, on the one hand, can be a product of your own insecurity and narcissism, of course. But that doesn't negate the fact that for a healthy person, jealousy and a healthy relationship, jealousy actually is the other side of love. It is an immensely protective. I love you and this relationship so much that I will kick your butt if you try to mess with my wife, right? And so another way of looking at this is to think about what kind of love could produce this type of jealousy in recognizing that the wrong worship of God is that adulterous, is that problematic. It draws you that far away from what should be your true experience of love. God is your true love. And why in the world would you be, you know, having an affair with this? And so, for me, the main counterintuitive arguments are arguments from love that get to that point. I don't know if that helps or doesn't make any sense at all. But
that's very helpful, yeah.
So on this, you made a comment, I can't remember exactly what you said, but right at the beginning of the lecture, you made a comment about how sort of now, how we think about love or how love is sort of framed in our culture. Could you just talk a little bit about that, about sort of how you see that playing out kind of on the ground now and comparing that with kind of what the Bible tells us that love is?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you see this, and again, I speak a little bit in parenting style. I mean, you see this in, as a parent, I mean, in parenting styles, you know, the different... I was very surprised. So several years back, maybe 6-7 years back, you know, when my son was smaller, but like 5, 6, 7, 8, around that age, I was at church and I called him Buddy. Hey, buddy, you know, we got to get to Sunday school now. I don't even know what I was talking specifically about, but I used the word buddy. And there was someone who was around 70 years old at that time, older gentleman, and we have a very close friendship, so he could speak quite freely with me. And he said, you know, I just don't understand this generation of parents. In our day, we would never call our kids buddy. There's kind of, we were the parents. Buddy is what we called our peers. there's this kind of zeitgeist right now in parenting, right? I mean, everyone wants to be their kid's buddy. Now, maybe it's because we had emotionally distant parents and we're trying to make up for that, and so the pendulum has swung the other way, and so, you know, there's an intimacy. So I still call him buddy. Unabashedly so. Because I'm experiencing intimacy with him that I did not have with my own dad. So, yeah. Am I overcompensating? Sure. Fine. I embrace that. But his comment struck me, and it stuck with me, on a broader cultural and theological basis. And that is, we prize intimacy. Our culture prizes intimacy, familiarity. And that vision of love, while true and emphasizing the intimacy, deeply de-emphasizes the fact of righteousness, the element of righteousness in love. There is a holy, Scripture thinks about a holy love and not just a buddy love, right? And so we like Jesus as the Lamb in his first incarnation, but Jesus as the Lion in his second, you know, that just doesn't make sense, despite C.S. Lewis and Aslan. Honestly, most of us, we're not going to really like Jesus in his second coming. He is going to terrify us. This is the Jesus I want to go to bed and look up at my wall, and, you know, I want to see this picture of Jesus. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? I mean, our culture. I'm not saying it's like I first. But our culture. This is the image. This is why this shows up in all the Christian knick-knack stuff, right? This is where I got it from, the Christian knick-knack stuff. Yeah. So, to get to your point, I mean, I think there is this problem of an overemphasis on intimacy and forgetting transcendence, that there is a transcendence and a muscularity, a power to love, even a terrifying element of love. Love, as fully revealed in God, should scare us because of its call to holiness, because it is the most loving thing for us to be like God. And that actually terrifies us if we know it truly.
I think that's something, I mean, even the question posed in the title of your talk, I think people see Jesus and that's something that looks familiar.
Yes, yeah.
But what they see in the Old Testament is so other.
Yes.
It doesn't look anything like love as we talk about it in our lives and relationships now.
I can't. Was there something back then? Yeah. No. Okay. No.
I just thought one of the things that I've often thought about this very question is that the assumption that God of the Old Testament is mean and Jesus is nice, so we'll take Jesus, overlooks tremendous passages in the Old Testament about God's mercy and patience and forbearance and everything, and then completely overlooked everything Jesus says about judgment. So Jesus is. You can only have that view if you pretty heavily edit the things that Jesus says.
Yeah.
About hell, for instance.
Yeah.
And so that's just something that I almost want to say, like, you know what? I'm glad you like Jesus, but I'm not sure you do.
Yeah. You don't really know him.
That's a great evangelistic.
Yeah. I wouldn't lead with that. Maybe. But yes, that's true. I mean, he's the one that told us parables about weeping and gnashing of teeth, being cast into the outer darkness. So, maybe one last question. Or, not to put the pressure on you. But go ahead.
Something actually that I've observed and that actually makes me struggle a little bit more with Jesus than the God of the Old Testament is the God of the Old Testament appears to me in many ways to be very specific and exacting. Hmm. He gives law. He provides very specific instructions for the tabernacle.
Mm-hmm.
When he's initiating the covenant administration with Abraham, he tells him to get like an oddly specific number of cows, goats, turtle doves that are not meant to be divided and passed between. But Jesus is like very vague in a lot of ways. There aren't any... I feel like Peter basically all the time, like, please tell me what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I don't really get it. That's not really a question, more an observation, and I wonder why that might be the case.
Yeah.
Maybe it may have to do with the legal moral distinction, or maybe not, but I'm not entirely sure what to make of that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in Jeremiah 31, you know, the new covenant that prophesies the coming of the Messiah speaks of this new situation, talks about the law being written on the heart. And no one will have to teach each other because the law will be written on everyone's heart. So already there's a recovery. So here's the good legal principle. You only create laws when you have problems. Right? So if there's no problem, if everyone got along, you wouldn't need to create a law. You only need to create a law when someone murders someone, then you need to have laws that stipulate the punishment. But in a society in which there's no murder ever, there would be no laws about murder. You actually see this unfolding in the new, all throughout the Old Testament. Genesis chapter 1 and 2, there's only one law. Don't eat fruit from that tree. Right? The tree of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. Other than that, there was no law. Adam was given no instructions. Don't murder, don't lie, nothing. There was no need for it. Because at that point, the law really was written on his heart. And so there was only one thing he had to obey, and of course he screwed up, and Adam and Eve obviously messed up. Then again, you know, again, after that, when's the law? Genesis chapter 9. The law against murder. It occurs there. So after there was a bunch of murdering going on, then God finally says, we need to create a law. Each of these instances through the Old Testament, you actually see laws only being introduced when Israel screws up. So in Exodus chapter 19, God tells them, you will be a kingdom of priests. You'll be a royal priesthood and a kingdom and a people of my own belonging. And then there's no law. It's just the call of identity. Then a basic Ten Commandments are given. So it's, but, you know, when they screw up and they do the golden calf thing that Ben was talking about, that's when Leviticus comes in. So all throughout the Bible, you actually see this principle in which laws are not needed when the Spirit is actually being obeyed. It's only when the Spirit is disobeyed. So how does that play into the New Testament? Well, it plays in this way. The Spirit of God now resides in New Testament believers. The law has been written on our hearts. There's actually something fundamentally being conveyed there. That there is, in the New Testament economy, a power source that just conceptually does not require the law in the same way that the Old Testament did. The fundamental belief in the transformative work of Jesus in our lives, such that we don't need to be given all these stipulations. And again, I see this in my own son's life and daughter's life. I hope that I don't have to detail every single thing of his behavior and her behavior. And I relish the day that I can say, you know, I have launched into the world two well-adjusted human beings that they could pretty much, in any new situation, figure out what the right thing is to do, even if they don't have a legal precedent. Because they are the right person. They don't need the right law because they are the right person. And I think that's what's happening in the New Testament, that now you have become, in Christ, the right person. And so from your Spirit, it doesn't need to be stipulated in that particular way. I think there is something that intuitive sense that you're getting of the specificity of the Old Testament versus the broadness of the New Testament, I think is getting at this actual dynamic. All right, well,
this is another question. This is just a book that Dick often gives to our students, which is called Strange Home Compound. I don't know if you wrote it, but
no.
A wonderful sort of modern well, not that modern, but it's the story of a Japanese, it's a true story of a Japanese prison camp where a whole lot of expats and people were put together in much too little space in China. Much too little space. And the Japanese just... The Japanese just gave them minimal water, food, and so on. And what it fits in what you were saying about the role of law. And it's actually the story, the guy who became a Christian, Langdon Gilkey, he became a Christian through his experience there because of seeing sin, seeing human nature under stress, where there wasn't enough food, there wasn't enough space. And he really comes out of that story in a wonderful way. The role of law, that you don't have a law is not the pinnacle.
Yeah.
Law is not, you're working in a really imperfect place, and perfect laws would just lead people to break them.
Yes.
And they couldn't do it. It's a book that a lot of people have found helpful, and it's just to sort of put in a much more modern context exactly what you've been talking about.
It was about 1,200 people stuck at a place built for 200. The Japanese said, govern yourselves, figure it out. And he's telling the story of what happens in the microcosm of human society. It's absolutely fascinating.
Wow.
And what they all worked out. And they're on the edge of killing each other much of the time.
Yeah.
But they don't. They managed to work out how to do it. You've seen Chariot of Fire, that's where Eric Little died.
Okay.
All the expats in China were rounded up and put in there. It's really interesting.
Thank you for that.
It helps make that concept, which I think is so helpful. Thank you very much.
No, that's fantastic. Well, thank you. I'll still hang around for a little bit, but thanks.